Good evening. Welcome. This is Dr. Nalini Chilko. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last about 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl and then we'll move into case studies and questions from you. Please be mindful of patient privacy and ensure that all discussions are confidential and patient identifying information is redacted on all records or in all questions. For reference, you're currently muted, but please feel free to press *7 to unmute your line if you have a question or a comment to add as we are in our discussions. I generally will leave space at the end of each topic for people to ask questions. So let's get started, and we'll begin with a clinical pearl. And this month, I wanted to talk more about biomarkers because there are so many questions about how to evaluate patients. And so we're continuing to look at how we can measure the tumor microenvironment and have some handholds. So I'm going to talk about three more biomarkers that are actually quite often on routine labs or more common labs that are done in the internal medicine primary care office, things you might be looking at and don't know that they're really part of this tumor microenvironment. So I'm going to start with lactic acid dehydrogenase. That's LDH on most lab reports. Now, LDH is often a sign of tumor cell proliferation because lactic acid is a byproduct of glycolysis. And remember that tumor cells shift into glycolysis as their primary metabolism, and therefore they produce a lot of lactic acid. And this is why the area around tumor cells is also more acidic, because literally there's more lactic acid being produced as a byproduct of glycolysis. Remember, the Warburg effect is that shift in metabolism that cancer cells that have inefficient mitochondria shift to make their energy. Now, you'll see LDH often elevated in aggressive cancers and also in hematologic malignancies, not just in solid tumors. And so it can be a marker of early carcinogenesis and can be a marker of disease progression. And it also indicates poor prognosis because it means that the cancer cells are actively metabolizing. So that's a good thing to keep an eye on. Above 245 is really where you start to consider it high. It's elevated commonly in melanomas, lymphomas, leukemias, and testicular cancers like seminoma, germ cell cancers. You'll see this in pancreatic cancers, gastric cancers, lung cancers, renal cell, et cetera, lots of cancers will exhibit this. And so we consider this a very poor prognosis for disease-free survival and overall survival. So we might be doing a lab like this at the beginning and getting a baseline. We might then repeat a lab like this about 6 or 8 weeks after someone finishes their conventional oncology therapies to get a new baseline and then track every 3 to 6 months to see where trend is. So this is definitely a red flag if you see elevated LDH in these patients. Now, another marker is serum albumin. When serum albumin is low, below 3.5, then we have the patient is in a state tipping into cachexia, and maybe malnutrition might be contributing to that. Remember that cancer patients have a metabolism where they go into sarcopenia readily early in the process. You might not see it in the amount of muscle mass subjectively, but it's usually going on early in the process. And cancer patients also are unable to really utilize their proteins normally. So Malnutrition can be a contributor to this, but the sarcopenia and cachexia of cancer are also contributors to low serum albumin. So we want to be mindful of nutritional repletion, making sure our patients are getting nutrient-dense diets and adequate oral protein. And sometimes in these patients that have lost their appetite or nauseous or have mouth sores or they're getting radiation to their head and neck and their throat is swollen, it can be a challenge. So remember to use a therapeutic nutrient-dense shake in patients like that to make sure that their protein is repleted and adequate, about 60 grams a day minimum, up to 80 grams a day when you see sarcopenia and cachexia. And really, when the patient is in this state, their quality of life is very poor. They usually feel very weak. They're often not responding to treatment well, and they are more at risk for adverse toxic effects from their treatments. And when you see a low serum albumin, then you also have a poor prognosis for survival. And it's also a sign of frailty. You know, as a patient gets more sarcopenic, as cancer is more advanced, you see this albumin start to drop. So remember, there's no one marker that we're looking at. We're looking at a landscape and patterns. So if you see high LDH, low albumin, high copper, high inflammation, high coagulation factors, things we've talked about before in previous calls, then you're seeing a pattern of active cancer terrain. And so you want to be monitoring this all the time. So we use this serum albumin also as a prognostic, right? We want to know when we're looking at patients how at risk they are for progression or recurrence. And so we look at these biomarkers in that context. And so this syndrome is called hypoalbuminemia. And so keep your eye on that, because that's really on a metabolic panel. You'll be able to see the albumin. You have to order the lactic acid dehydrogenase as a separate test. And so you're also going to then see on your complete metabolic panels and routine panels, you can see that low albumin to globulin ratio also. And so again, that's a significator of disease progression, increased chemotoxicity, and poor prognosis for survival, and likely sarcopenia and cachexia developing or present. And so you'll see a kind of slight or not present at all in the early stages, but with progression, it can be quite dramatic. If you are treating stage 3 and 4 cancer patients, you will see this on their labs. Now, elevated ferritin is also common in cancer patients for several reasons. Number one, it's a reflection of acute phase inflammation. And so we can see different markers of inflammation in the landscape of cancer. So ferritin would be one of them. Ceruloplasmin is also a marker of inflammation, as of course is CRP, C-reactive protein, and also SED rate, often seen as ESR on the panel. So you want to look at all the markers of inflammation, and then sometimes I'll order inflammatory cytokines like interleukin 6 and interleukin 8 as well. And when you see those, then it's very likely that metastatic progression is occurring. So back to ferritin. Ferritin is definitely a strong survival predictor. And so all the three that I'm talking about this evening really are very prognostic. And remember that trend is important when looking at biomarkers. One measurement, one piece of data by itself isn't useful in an isolated fashion. So you want to look at the other factors that you've measured, but also you want to look at trend over time. And so then you will see the direction, whether the patient's cancer is resolving or progressing. And so definitely reduced survival time and increased risk of mortality when you start to see the ferritin climb, because it means they're super inflamed. And you'll see all the inflammatory markers start to go up, as patients' cancer becomes out of control, is progressing, and mortality is at risk. So ferritin, over 200 nanograms per ml in men and slightly lower in women, because menstruating women at least have less iron and iron storage. So over 150 nanograms per ml in women would be an indication of inflammation, immunosuppression, angiogenesis, and proliferation. So those are your big significators. And so that's my clinical pearl for this evening, is you have now three more biomarkers that you can take a look at. And these are a little bit more common and less a specialty type of tests that are ordered. So you may have these also in medical records that you receive and are reviewing on the patient. You can take a look at these factors. So I'm going to take a break. You can hit star 7 if you want to ask about any of these biomarkers. And I'll pause here. Hit star 7 if you want to ask a question. Okie dokie. This is all pretty straightforward. So let me go on. We received quite a few questions for this call. We didn't actually receive a case study, so I'm going to go through all the questions next, and then I have a couple of recently published papers I want to bring to your attention. So Beth asks, how do you approach women who would still like to conceive who are prescribed tamoxifen? Any insight on cancer medication and fertility? So first of all, let me answer that in a broader way. You know, chemotherapy also affects fertility, so we want to think about that. And so women who are still in their childbearing years in general are often counseled to harvest some of their eggs and freeze them so that if they go into menopause as a result of their chemotherapy or hormonal suppression therapies, if when they stop those therapies, their ovaries don't resume function, then they still have some eggs that they have if they want to have children of their own genetics. So in general, make sure that the patient has been counseled about that. That's pretty routine these days in younger women. Now, tamoxifen, when is tamoxifen used? This is a drug that is in the class we call SERMs, S-E-R-M. And these are receptor modulators. So this particularly modulates the estrogen receptor. So SERM stands for selective estrogen receptor modulator. And what that means in this case, SERM basically blocks the estrogen receptor. So tamoxifen is used in women who are still premenopausal, when the ovaries are still active. So the ovaries remain active and continue to produce estrogen. So what you'll see in women who are on tamoxifen is you'll see high serum estradiol levels. So don't be alarmed when you see that, because the body thinks there's no estrogen available, so the ovary keeps being stimulated because the cells can't take it up. And so this is literally blocking the receptor. And the adverse effects of tamoxifen, the most typical and common, are that it affects the uterine lining because there's so much estrogen around. So the uterine lining will thicken, and uterine cancer is a side effect of tamoxifen. So I have all of my women patients who are on tamoxifen have a uterine ultrasound to look at the thickness of their endometrial lining every 6 months. And if it is too thick, you have to take a break from the tamoxifen. If you have a patient on tamoxifen who is spotting, that could be a sign of uterine cancer. And so you want to jump on that. I had a patient many years ago who was a Kaiser patient in California. Kaiser is one of the big HMOs, and they're really notoriously poor care. And this woman had uterine bleeding well on tamoxifen for over 6 months, and her oncologist never ever did an endometrial ultrasound and never did an endometrial biopsy to see if she was developing uterine cancer. So I had to say, you know, you really should be having that. And so you go back as an educated patient to your oncologist and say, hey, you should have done this on me months ago. I want to do it now. So be mindful. Sometimes we're going to help the patient to be an educated patient. Also, because of the high serum estrogen levels, there is a greater risk of a thromboembolic event. And so I always monitor the fibrinogen activity and the D-dimer to look at the amount of coagulation that's going on. Remember that hypercoagulation is a fact of tumor cell physiology. And so usually when women are on tamoxifen, they have finished their surgery or chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and this is a maintenance to block estrogen receptors and kind of starve out any estrogen receptor positive cells that might be left on a microscopic level. So tamoxifen is only used in estrogen receptor positive cancers, and it's primarily used in breast cancer, although I've seen tamoxifen used in brain cancers where there's estrogen receptors. I've seen it used in pancreatic cancers where there's estrogen receptors. So it's not limited to breast cancer. It's for tumor cells that express estrogen receptors. And after menopause, tamoxifen is not used. And after menopause, for women who have estrogen receptor positive cancers, we use the aromatase inhibitors instead, which are much safer in my mind. They don't have this risk of uterine cancer. They don't have this big risk of blood clots and thromboembolic events like pulmonary embolisms and strokes because estrogen is low. They have more of the symptoms of menopause. So I've given you a couple of reference articles on this topic if you want to read more deeply. One is called The Use of Tamoxifen Before and During Pregnancy. Another is The Impact of Fertility Concerns on Tamoxifen Initiation and Persistence. Tamoxifen is now recommended for 5 to 10 years, so that would dramatically impact a woman's ability to bear a child. And then the third article is Safety of Tamoxifen During Pregnancy, 3 case reports. So just as a education for our patients also, because the ovaries are still active when you're on tamoxifen, then a woman could get pregnant, and lots of birth defects are associated with tamoxifen use at the time of conception. So a woman would have to terminate her pregnancy because the likelihood of a lot of problems would be there. Many of those pregnancies actually would not be able to persist because of so much genetic damage, but it's important to educate patients about that. And it's recommended that there be a period of about 2 months post tamoxifen use before a woman would try to get pregnant and not be in this risk category. So that's the answer to that question. Have a plan to save some eggs just in case the woman does not resume fertility and ovarian activity. And then be mindful of the side effects of tamoxifen and be mindful of making sure a woman is using birth control of some kind while she's on tamoxifen. That's really very important. Okay. Then Corey has a question, a couple of questions. How often do biopsies need to be analyzed to adjust precise treatment due to cancer's adaptability? So that's an interesting question. So remember that we don't even have the ability to biopsy every single person. Sometimes there is no mass. Maybe there's just, say, an ovarian cancer. The woman's had surgery and there's a high CA 125 tumor marker, but the cancer is diffuse. It's lots of diffuse cells throughout the pelvis or throughout the body. There's nothing to biopsy. Sometimes you can take some fluid from the pelvic cavity, but again, we don't want to do invasive procedures where it's not really warranted. The other part of your question is what about adjusting precise treatment? So really, we want to reanalyze tissue if a patient has had treatment and either has some remaining tissue that was unresponsive to the treatment, or more often a second or third biopsy occurs when there is a recurrence, because those cells are definitely going to be different. So if a woman has or a man has a successfully treated cancer and then they get a recurrence, those new cells are more likely to be biopsied. The standard of care now is to limit biopsies. The use of genomics and proteomics is not standard of care. And so when I get a patient who has a recurrence, I insist on getting some tissue and doing some analysis so we can have personalized decision making. And some oncologists are willing to do that and some are not. You also need a surgeon who's willing to get the tissue, and you need a significant tissue sample. So if there's only a little blip on the screen, you're not going to get enough tissue to actually have to analyze. So there are multiple factors. Typically, if a patient is unresponsive to treatment and they never had an analysis of their tissue, then it's warranted to get another tissue sample. But, you know, it has to be someplace you can get at it. And so there are limiting factors, but we want to, for typically standard of care is, you know, the oncologist doesn't do a personalized look, gives standard of care cocktail of treatment and hopes that the patient is responsive. So, you know, some patients have really excellent results, some patients have partial results, and some patients are unresponsive. So I prefer not to be guessing and know ahead of time what would be a good selection of therapy for the patient. But remember, we also are looking at other things now with monoclonal antibodies and with immunotherapies. So there is more testing that we can do besides genomics and proteomics. We can look at what types of receptors are there. So it's just the answer to your question, Corey, is you don't want to over biopsy anybody because it's traumatic. And a lot of times there's not enough tissue that could be gathered. So those are all the factors that you really have to think about. You also asked another question, and that is, what about the advanced modules? So I built this foundation course and intended to give a good foundation so that you could get started, but I have so many more advanced topics that I want to teach in depth. The clinical pearls here are, I think, where the more advanced training is happening right now. And I also want to add more in-depth to the module on the impact of diet and nutrition and therapeutic diets on cancer, because I think that's quite confusing. So that's the first thing I'm going to do. I'm going to put right into the foundations course an expanded lecture on food and diet and therapeutic diets for cancer patients. And then over time, I'm going to build some modules. I have modules planned for what do you do when you have a patient who's a diabetic and a cancer patient, and what is the impact of blood sugar, obesity, and insulin on cancer risk and cancer progression and recurrence. I also want to do a module on a really in-depth module on the impact of cancer and cancer therapy on cognitive impairment. I want to do a really in-depth module on long-term cancer-related and cancer treatment-related fatigue. I like to do a deeper, longer lecture on cancer survivorship, and I'd also like to do some things on sarcopenia and cachexia. There's a lot. So if you are interested in a particular topic that you want an advanced lecture on, that's where I am in the process now. And I think they'll just be released one at a time. It doesn't make any sense to me to make a bunch of them and withhold them until I have a block of of lectures to create a whole advanced course. So for those of you in the course, you'll have access to those as they come out. And so just stay tuned. And since we have this question on the table, you know, let us know what you're interested in having a full deep lecture on for anything that's not in the course. Let's see. You also ask, how often should one run transcriptomics when looking at aggressive cancers? So transcriptomics, which is proteomics really, is new. And so we don't really know how often that changes. It's really quite new. And what we're looking at is not the genomics, but which genes actually get transcribed, what genes are active, and therefore what functional proteins are active in that patient's cancer. And I think that's a lot more important to look at, but there aren't very many labs that do it, and it's usually a really long lead time. It could take up to 8 weeks to get the results, but if you have a treatment-resistant cancer, then you would want to do something that would help you figure out what's really going on. But I wouldn't do testing like this any more than every 6 months, and depending where the patient is in their process. And also, there's a few labs, long lead time, it's very expensive, it's out of pocket. So I think it might be great to start looking at if there are clinical trials that are going on in this and get patients into it. But it's a minimum of $5,000 out of pocket for the patient on these tests. And remember that this type of testing, it's just a piece of decision making. And we also want to be really looking at the tumor microenvironment much more frequently. So I get a baseline at the beginning, and then depending where the patient is in the process during chemo, I'm watching things that I can still measure during chemo that wouldn't be artifacts of the treatment. So I look at vitamin D. I want to watch inflammation. I want to watch blood clotting. I want to watch, of course, the CBC, the things that are adverse effects of the cancer. I'm measuring those maybe every month during treatment, or I'm asking the oncologist every time they do a blood draw to do a handful of tests that I'm interested in during treatment. And then when a patient completes chemotherapy, I usually wait about 6 or 8 weeks and then do a complete assessment of the tumor microenvironment. So for the OutSmart cancer model that we're working in, we focus much more on the tumor microenvironment. So I'm monitoring that usually every 3 months for the first 2 years after someone completes their treatment. If you have a patient with advanced disease and they're living with cancer as a chronic illness, then I'll still do it every 3 or 4 months. If a patient's physiology seems pretty stable, I'll do it every 6 months. And remember that people have had a lot of chemotherapy, their veins are shot, and so it's really hard for them to have frequent blood draws. And so I take that into account and how often I order. And for these patients who really have very collapsed veins from having a lot of chemotherapy, if they didn't have a port, then you have them drink a lot of water with a little bit of salt in it before they get their blood drawn. And that, of course, keeps more fluid in the body and in the tissue and in the blood vessels by having the salt there. But also, I have some people, it's very hard for nurses to do venipuncture at all. And then I give them right before they have their blood draw, I give them a tablespoon of hawthorn berry extract, which is a vasodilator, and that's Crataegus, and it's full of antioxidants too. It's a great botanical, and so I use that, and then a good nurse will put hot compresses on to dilate the blood vessels, but good hydration with a little salt. And then it's really challenging if you give the an extract, not a capsule, a liquid extract of the hawthorn berry. It'll quickly dilate the vessels, and you get a little window of time where you can get that needle in and do a blood draw. But you have to remember that you can't just send these patients for blood draws because they don't have the veins for them to easily do that. So that's kind of my rhythm. It depends where the patient is, how concerned I am. If they have, for example, high risk of thrombus, then I might do that more often, and I might also make sure the oncologist is cognizant of that. And, you know, we make a plan. I just had a patient whose coagulation factors were triple what they should be. And I asked the oncologist to order Rovinox, low molecular weight heparin, because I don't have any herbs to quickly coagulate her. And she was extremely high risk. She's a stage 4 treatment resistant ovarian cancer patient. So that was going to bring her into a realm of safety much more quickly. So how often depends on what's going on with the patient. But those are some ballpark ways. Then Kathy asks, is colostrum a viable, useful supplement for cancer patients? And are there any contraindications with medicine or therapies? So colostrum, it's really the lactoferrin that's in colostrum that has an impact and has the most active physiologic functions. I don't actually use it very often unless a person has really high iron, because it'll chelate iron. And that's the main reason, or the main indication when I use it. It's an iron binding glycoprotein. But remember, it comes from milk, and it should be highly purified, shouldn't trigger anybody who's milk sensitive. It has other functions. It's antimicrobial, antiviral. That's why it's used when people have infections to increase good response. It does have some antioxidant and anti-cancer activity. It can be anti-inflammatory, but it's mild. You know, it's really mild. So I'm very mindful of how many pills I ask someone to take. And you've all seen my treatment plans. I already ask people to take a lot of pills. So something has to be a big lever for me to add another pill to someone's protocol. So I'll use literally lactoferrin rather than colostrum to chelate iron. But there is this good positive immune effect. So, well, you know, you can decide. People have different styles of treatment. There are many people who include colostrum as part of a immune tonification protocol. And there's good rationale for that. Absolutely good rationale for that. And I've given you a couple of references on lactoferrin. One, lactoferrin's major physiologic functions and applications. And another article, lactoferrin in the context of inflammation-induced pathology, frontiers in immunology. That's a pretty good paper if you want to look more at the immunomodulatory effects of lactoferrin. So that's mainly why people give colostrum. Then we have another question. Oh, no, that's all the questions. So let me stop there. Oh, no, there's one more question. Sorry. Susan asks, I'd like to know where you and your patients obtain powdered supplements such as resveratrol, ginkgo, and milk thistle. So this seems to come up really often. And so this means you're probably new and didn't hear the call that we talked about that on, or you didn't listen to the recording. So I think I'm going to put in the library, I'm going to make a list of some of the suppliers I think are reliable. So keyword reliable. I am very picky about who I get supplements and botanicals from, and the list seems to get shorter and shorter over time. For powdered herbs, present tense, I really like Golden Lotus Herbs, and they have a website that if you just go to their website and don't have a professional login, then you won't see all the products they actually carry. So you have to contact them and ask them for a professional account. And then they'll give you a different login and you can see everything they carry. And they carry a lot of powders. They carry a lot of liquid botanical extracts. And they have some traditional Chinese formulas. But I actually buy my milk thistle powder, and they have an amazing high quality maca powder. I've gotten schizandra powder from them. I believe they have ginkgo, and they can get resveratrol. So this company is owned by a guy named Dave Ehrlichman, and I really like working with his company. It's a small company. They give a lot of personal service, and he really is very careful about his suppliers and certificates of analysis for every single batch. And so I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but that's what you want to look for. So Dave is really trustworthy. He has some suppliers of organic botanicals in China. So he's very thoughtful about that. So he gives a lot of personal service. If there's something, an herb I want, he'll find it for me. He'll really find it. There's another company, they don't have powders, but they have really high quality extracts. That's Heron Herbs, and that's Eric Yarnell's company. Eric is a brilliant, brilliant naturopath and an amazing herbalist, and he has some herbs that aren't available from other companies, and he also has just incredibly high standards for the quality, and he's a great resource if you want to talk to someone about herbs. And so their website has their catalog on it, but they don't do powders. They just do botanical extracts. So right now, historically, I've gotten almost everything from Golden Lotus. So the next question is, what do you think of commercial online sources like Bulk Herbs? No, no, no. So you have to vet every manufacturer and every supplier. And it's my feeling that these online companies are not doing their due diligence. I could be wrong, but the way you find out is if you want to buy something from a company, you go, can I see the certificate of analysis for the current batch? And you word it like that, because they might have an old certificate of analysis for something they bought 2 years ago. It's not what they're selling now. What does that mean? That means whatever they purchased, there was a laboratory assay on it to look at contamination and concentration. What isn't in those certificate of analysis typically is whether or not the product is authentic. So are you actually buying curcumin, or are you buying a yellow ginger root? And so there's a lot of false labeling. And when a raw material is not available, they'll be counterfeit. And unless you have a certificate that also shows that the raw material was authenticated and what they say it is actually what it is, if a company won't answer those questions for you, then you know they're not doing it. And so what you're looking for is what they're selling you actually what's in the package, or is it a counterfeit product? It's incredibly common in the herb business these days because there's a shortage of a lot of herbs. You also want to know what the concentration is. And if the last time you bought it, it was 98% pure resveratrol, and that would affect your dosing if the batch you got now is 50%. And so what's the other 50%? So you need to know that. And you also need to know that it was assayed for contaminants, herbicides, pesticides, and solvents. And so I think this is a great question, because most clinicians don't know what goes on in the nutraceutical botanical industry. But I used to be in the industry, and I do know what goes on. So you have to be so mindful. So if you're not sure about a company, what I would do is contact them and say, I want to buy this product from you. Could you send me the certificate of analysis on the current batch that you're selling? And do you also have an authentication that the material is actually what you say it is? And if they won't answer your question, they're not doing it. Any company that's doing it is happy to immediately send you those documents. So that is my answer to that question. So now that is the last of the question list. And then I have some great research articles to share with you. So I'm going to take a break. And anybody who has any other questions or wants to clarify anything I just said, you can hit *7 and I'd be happy to answer your question. Well, either I am being incredibly clear, or maybe you guys aren't able to ask, but I will go on then. Oh, all right.
Hi, this is Stacy. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Hi.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I had a *7 and it worked. So.
Oh, good. Good.
So I just wanted to give you my perspective of how I do the repeat biopsies. I'm an oncologist. And
oh,
so
great. Yeah, great.
I actually do a lot of rebiopsying, especially at recurrence. And I send typically to Foundation Medicine, and sometimes I'll send to Caris.
Mm-hmm.
But usually we'll send it to Foundation and we'll get all of the mutations
mm-hmm.
within the tumor. And the reason I do that is we do have a lot of clinical trials open now that are called bucket trials.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is if you have a mutation, then there's a whole list, like a 4-page list of mutations and drugs that match that mutation.
Right, right.
So they'll
right.
actually give you
yes.
the patient the drug if they qualify. So we have a MATCH trial and TAPER trial. And so it's really interesting because you think that those drugs would work, but they don't. They just published like an ASCO abstract of a targeted therapy for bile duct. They had a bile duct cohort that had a specific mutation, and it was thought to be a driver mutation, and it was just completely negative. So it's so much more complicated than just,
yes.
you know, one target.
Yes,
and
it is.
The other point I was going to say is if you can't get a biopsy, we also now do liquid biopsies.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can get kind of similar information if you're looking for that type of thing.
So are you doing cell-free tumor DNA also?
I haven't done that. I've just done, the only thing I've done lately is if I can't get a biopsy, I've just done the Foundation liquid biopsy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I haven't been, you know, that's pretty much all I've been doing.
Do you do circulating tumor cells?
I don't. I typically, because my, the practice that I have is mainly brain tumors.
Oh, wow.
And then I also do some gynecologic, and I just haven't really, I know the breast cancer doctors do sometimes, and sometimes the colon cancer doctors do.
So there are, you get insurance reimbursement for prostate, breast, and colorectal cancer circulating tumor cells, but the lab that I'm using, BioCept, which is in Southern California, they will do that on other cancers as part of research and data collection. So you actually can get circulating tumor cells on other types of cancers. I don't know about brain cancers, but I think they're a better lab. They're a newer lab. And I think a lot of oncologists just weren't doing when Cell Search was the only lab around. And,
right.
You know, they
right.
didn't do a very good job. They weren't very reliable, but BioCept has a different technology, and I really like them. You might want to talk with them because they're doing research, you know? They're doing
okay.
research.
Oh, that's great.
And they're pretty collaborative. But to go back to your point, you know, I think this idea that you can find one trait in a tumor cell and base your whole treatment plan on that, that's a drug model, you know, that's a silver bullet
yep.
kind of model. And I think the challenge of cancer is it's so complicated. It's so multifactorial. We want to understand the characteristics of the tumor cell, and we want to understand the tumor microenvironment. We want to understand the genomics of the patient. But, you know, it's so multifactorial that looking for one thing, I think, you know, maybe there's a few cancers where you get that, but my experience, like you do something like Tarceva or Opdivo, you get a short result, right? Because you only hit one thing.
Right, or just sort of a partial kind
yeah.
of tiddly
yeah.
response.
Yeah,
yeah exactly. It's,
you know, and
yeah,
the more advanced cancer patient already has a heterogeneous population of cells, so you pick one thing, you only get part of the cancer cells. Are you there, Stacey?
Yep, oh. I totally agree.
Yeah, so
totally
you have anything
agree.
Else to say since you're our resident oncologist?
I have a lot to say. But
well, we have time. Go ahead. Do a clinical pro for us.
I just, you know, I... that was my main thought for the day is that
okay.
I'm so discouraged. You know, everybody is so hyped up on immunotherapy. Oh, we got to do this immunotherapy. You have to get this targeted therapy, and it just is you know, there are very few people in which it works well.
That's
and
right.
It's really, really frustrating. And I think it's difficult for patients, you know, because you're kind of dangling this carrot in front of them, and it's not really fair, because it's just not, it's way too complicated for that. And that's the reason I'm here. Because I just have done this long enough and I know that it's,
Let me make a comment and ask a question. Number one is, when I do those kinds of analyses, I do also like Foundation One and Caris Life Sciences. I like those labs a lot, just so everyone else can hear that. Let me ask you your opinion on something. So I have a patient who is an endometrial stage four patient, and she had a pretty good response to aggressive chemotherapy. There was a little bit left on one of her ovaries in her pelvis. And she has the most amazing oncologist that I work closely with at UCLA, Dr. Gottfried Konecny. And so he put her on Keytruda, and she had an extreme reaction and got incredibly severe colitis from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it took a long time. She had to be on high doses of steroids, and she just had watery diarrhea for months, you know? And so it was like lighting a forest fire in her. But my question for you is, do you think that with that kind of response, that there's actually, even though she stopped taking Keytruda because it triggered that, do you think that that mobilization of the immune system is still impacting her cancer?
I think it can. I think that, was she microsatellite unstable?
Yes.
Is that why they used it? Okay.
Yeah.
Usually we don't use that. And is there a reason they didn't just resect the ovary, do the surgery for it, or does she not want to do that?
I actually don't know the answer to that question.
Because sometimes, I mean, usually that comes out with the whole kitten.
Yeah.
But,
I think her disease is really, she has lung mets, so, you know.
Oh, lung mets too.
Yeah.
So the thing that we've seen with immunotherapy is the patients who have that rip-roaring response, you know, in terms of toxicity, are the ones that respond.
Yeah.
And so, and you see that also with agents like cetuximab or Erbitux or panitumumab, the EGFR inhibitors. The patients who get the rip-roaring rash are the ones who respond.
Yes.
So it's definitely, I think, a marker that the immune system is very primed and working, and I think it probably could continue to work.
Yeah, yeah. So another question I have is, you know, I think one of the bad habits of conventional medicine is this idea that more is better. So part of my thinking is if you trigger the immune system, don't keep hitting it, maybe we would have less adverse effects, but still mobilize an immune response.
Right. So maybe it's too frequent.
Yeah.
You know, it's the way they dose stuff is just so, you know, random. And the other thing that's interesting about immunotherapy is the role of the gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
So those papers just came out with the gut, how the bacterial ecosystem, the presence of certain bacteria portends for a good response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
absolutely
really interesting. And how do you manipulate that? And if you manipulate it, you might manipulate toxicity. You might get, like, if you're getting
right.
a good response.
That's right. That's
you might
right.
get too much toxicity. So I think it's going to be interesting how that plays out.
Yeah. I spoke about that briefly in one of the recent calls, and there are some papers in the library about that. And one of the things I talked about was how phytochemicals assist the microbiome in its functionality, and also the microbiome allows us to utilize phytochemicals more readily. And so obviously that's so with drugs as well.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'll just tell you one story for everyone. So Herceptin has been around a long time for HER2 new positive breast cancer. In fact, the research was done here in LA by Dennis Slaman, and I was actually treating some of his research subjects and saw early on what it could do. So I had a patient who was HER2 positive, and she'd had a course of Herceptin, but she really had cancer as a chronic illness. And I talked her oncologist into giving her Herceptin every 3 months, which was totally off label, but it kept her alive for a really long time.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I think more of these immunotherapies, more like vaccinations, you know, you want to mobilize something and train the immune system, but you don't want to keep stimulating that.
And if you look at like dendritic cell vaccines for brain tumors, that's mm-hmm. what they do. Mm-hmm. That's a different mechanism than
right.
Keytruda. So you're making the vaccine, you mix up the tumor with the, you do a apheresis, and then the lymphocytes get mixed with the tumor. Then you actually inject the dendritic cell vaccine into under the skin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you do it pretty frequently in the beginning, but then it gets spaced out. And it's exactly like that. It's a vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And it
mm-hmm.
works. They mm-hmm. just published the paper.
Yeah, yeah. So on one of our calls, I talked about dendritic cell vaccines too. So you can listen to that and tell me if I was right or it's accurate. All right. Thank you so much, Stacey. I'm going to go on.
Sure,
because,
sure. Yep.
I have a paper I want to present. So thank you very much. So the hot off the press news is the recent ASCO conference. There was a very, very large and long-term study that chemotherapy is not needed for most early breast cancer patients. And this has been in the news quite a lot. So it involved more than 10,000 patients, and it was using the Oncotype genomic health profile, looking at the genetic profile of these tumor cells. And this is only for estrogen receptor positive cancers. And so if the Oncotype score was 0 to 10, then it was very clear that no chemotherapy benefit would be accrued and only hormonal therapy would be given to the patient. It was also noted in this study that if the Oncotype score was above 26, that the patient was at very high risk for recurrence and then chemotherapy would be indicated. But there was this shade of gray in the middle of patients between 10 and 26, this mid-range. And so that was one of the reasons for this big study is, what do we do with those women? Should we give them chemo or should we not give them chemo? So again, this was a study with over 10,000 women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, also HER2 new negative and axillary node negative. So these are stage one patients, and having this mid-range recurrence score and an Oncotype of between 11 and 25. And so this study was done over a very long period of time, and it concluded over 9 years that the rates were similar in both groups for disease-free survival and for distant recurrence and for overall survival. And those survival rates were in the high 80s and high 90s. So this means that a lot of women will not be receiving chemotherapy anymore, which is really fantastic news. But the study also discovered that the age of the patient made a difference in whether or not you gave the patient chemotherapy. So chemotherapy appeared to have some benefit in patients who were 50 or younger with this mid-range recurrence score. And so age is a factor in making that decision too. And that makes sense because when you get cancer, breast cancer at least, and you're younger, it typically is a more aggressive tumor cell line. And so there you have a more aggressive cancer. And remember that if cells are fast dividing, they're also more responsive to chemotherapy. And so this just was all over the news because I think it means that a lot of drug companies aren't going to be selling as many drugs to women with breast cancer. So you should all be aware of that. I actually published the entire abstract in today's notes for you. And that is the end of my presentation. And so it looks like we have a few minutes left. If anyone wants to ask any more questions or make any more comments or share anything more. Star 7. Well, okay. I'll say good night to everyone. Thank you so much for your presence and attention. And thank you, Stacy, for being our resource. And the notes for this will be posted, I think, a little bit late because my assistant Emily is on vacation until Sunday. So be patient. But I do believe we gave you most of the notes to download ahead of time. I believe we're now publishing a link for you, so you have something to look at while I'm talking. And if you have requests for Clinical Pearl topics, and if you have requests for advanced modules, please let us know, and I'll absolutely include those. Thank you, everyone. Good night.